it's very interesting. It's like, our next speaker is Grover Natan, and the title of his talk is The Hardest Math I've Ever Really Used, by which he means not the hardest math I've ever really used, but the hardest math he's ever really used.
So, just one warning, I'm videotaping it because I'm going to put on the web a class that, sorry, it's working, that I will be giving next year, and I need to test run my technology, so don't worry. I'm just testing that everything works, and indeed everything so far works. The other thing is that I probably have too much time, so I'll start with two riddles. So, one is for the Green Theorem students. So it's my favorite application of Green's Theorem. And here's how it goes. It's called the planimeter, or I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway, it's a gadget that looks like that. It has two straight arms, and one of them is anchored to the plane. The other one has sort of a needle at the top, so it's kind of has a sharp needle at the top, and you can move the needle around. Now, there is also a wheel attached this way. Okay, so I'm looking at it from above, so the wheel looks like a line, but it's really a wheel. Now, you take some planar shape over here, and you just move the needle around the boundary of the planar shape. As you do it, the wheel spins. Okay? Well, that's what wheels tend to do. But it spins sort of, you know, when you have motion perpendicular to the direction of the wheel, it slides, right? If you take unicycle wheel and slide it sideways, it slides. If you move forward, it spins. Okay, so it actually registers only one component of the motion. Now, you count how many turns the wheel makes, and the claim is that the turning number of the wheel is equal to the area of this shape. Okay, and my question is, why? So it's a plane geometry question, or if you wish, a Green Theorem exercise. So, well, it's a riddle. I'm not going to tell you what the answer is. And the other riddle has to do with the cruelty of biologists. So I have to define a roach, first of all. So a roach is a thing that has a body, here's the body, and six legs. One, two, three, four, five, and six. Each leg is made out of two sticks that are connected to the body and connected to each other with a joint. So far, there is nothing cruel about it. This is just the fact of life. That's what a roach is. Now I have to tell you what biologists tend to do when they get an insect. So they pin the legs to a surface. So the legs are pinned. The end of the legs cannot move anymore. Okay? I'm sorry for the cruelty, it's not me. I've actually never done it in real life. All six. And then they take a glass, glass plate, okay, and cover everything from above so it becomes two-dimensional. Okay? Now, our poor roach still has a little bit of freedom of motion, right? Because the body can move to various places. So I'm assuming that the legs are almost tightly pulled, but not quite, okay? So our roach still has some freedom of motion. The body can still move around, but it's even a little more than that. Because if the body moves all the way, say, to the left, then this leg is now tight, and now the body can move backwards with the leg bending the other way. Okay? So there is a certain complicated space of states that the roach may have. And Mike, is it clear? So basically, to describe the roach, you need to describe the position of the body and the position of the six joints and the remaining freedom of motion. But these positions are constrained because the distance from the joint to the body has to be, well, the length of that leg, or the length of that piece of leg. Okay? So you get a certain space of states for that roach. And then my question is, what is this space? Can you identify this space? Can you give it a name? Is it, I don't know, a plane? Is it a sphere? Is it a torus? Is it a five-dimensional manifold, whatever manifold is, of some very strange shape? So what is it? And when you're done answering this, you should also tell me how it is related to the four-dimensional cube. Not the four-dimensional Rubik's cube, just the four-dimensional cube. Okay, it's not obvious. So that's my exercise. Is this okay? Are the questions at least well posed? Okay. If so, let's move to my, oh my God, what an idiot I am. This is all on record, oh no, I'm completely idiot. Sorry. So I forgot to distribute the handout. My talk will follow a handout, and you should each have a copy of it. So can you just pass it around, and I don't know, where should I start? Here, and pass it around. Okay, I'll be happy to keep the leftovers. Okay. Oh, and I guess we should turn off the light here. Okay. So I'm going to tell you about the hardest math problem I've ever really used in real life, and I have to explain. So obviously I've used very complicated math. Like every time I make a cell phone call, my voice gets compressed using discrete Fourier transforms. So, you know, it's heavy duty math. And then every time I use the digital camera, the image gets compressed in a certain way, and again, that's heavy-duty math. And every time I use a GPS device, there are actually some general relativity effects that go into it. But that's not math that I've done directly, okay? That's math that some other people cooked for me. It's not the math that I've used, okay? Then I tend to teach heavy-duty math. So, well, you know, I teach graduate courses and undergraduate courses, and I do research, and I use heavy-duty math, but this is somehow math for the purpose of math. It's not really math that I've used. So what's the hardest math that I've ever used personally without it being related to teaching to artificial activities, in some sense, to teaching mathematics or to doing research in mathematics? So, okay, I use addition and subtraction practically every day, like giving change, taking change, adding up the prices on my shopping list, things like that. I use multiplication rarely, maybe once a month or so. I end up buying something in bulk, and then I need to know how much five of something cost, if I know the unit price. But it doesn't happen very often. If you think about it, in your life too, probably it happens rarely. Also, when you need to paint a wall, okay, you need to figure out how much paint you need, so you need to calculate the area. But how often do you paint a wall? Okay? I've used powers twice in my life when I took a mortgage and I needed to compute compound interest. I needed to do compound interest calculations. My bankers were amused. I mean, they've never ever seen anyone before actually calculate anything rather than use the tables. But yes, I've used powers about twice in my life. And maybe I used a tiny bit of linear algebra, but that was it until a very long time ago, and I'm sort of very proud that recently I had to use a little bit of harder math, and I want to explain what it is. So it is actually, okay, here's the math. Let's explain what it is, first of all. So suppose you have, so here's the problem. Okay, so suppose you have a picture. Let's say it's the picture of the Mona Lisa. I think it's chopped right over there. Okay, but you know, let's pretend it's over here. And I want to take a picture of one eye, a video picture of one eye of the Mona Lisa, and then move my digital camera to the other eye and take a picture over there, and I want to sort of take a video of that. Okay? And the question is, how can I move my camera so as there would be the least image blur as I move? Right? When I move the camera, well, if I move it over a picture, well, actually, right now I'm making a shadow over the picture, so I, you know, the image is uniform. But pretend there is a real picture here. Okay. So when if I move the camera on a straight line from here to here, right, the image moves really, really, really fast on the screen, and you can barely see what it is. So clearly, it would be better to somehow pull the camera out a bit. When you're far, you can move faster without generating blur, and then move back in. Okay? And then my question is, what is the optimal path on which to move? How exactly should I move the camera? Okay? Now you can ask, how is it practical? So it's, or how is it practical for me? So it has to do with the way I give talks. So actually not the talks that I've been giving in the class that I'm giving here, because that's a series of talks. But when I give a single isolated talk, I tend to use a handout, because I want, so I tend to use a one page, can I borrow your handout? I tend to use a one page handout that has absolutely everything on it, because I want everything to be visible. I want people to be able to look back at formulas that that were shown in the beginning of the talk. I want them to be able to see what's in the future of that talk. And then I tend to zoom from one piece of the handout to another. I tend to zoom in into various pieces of the handout while giving the talk. So for example, if I'm giving a talk on the Rubik's Cube, at the end of the talk, I may quickly progress and say, well, we had a problem, here's the problem. We wrote a quick computer program to solve it. Here's the computer program. It solved the Rubik's Cube, but it could have just as well solved any of many other combinatorial problems. However, we still have a homework exercise that our program couldn't do, and I leave it as a challenge for you to do it. And then my question, well, I want to move my handout from one place to another, or move my viewport from one place to another, and I don't want my audience to be too dizzy. If I had just moved everything along straight lines like this, it will be, well, I mean, since I'm doing it with the mouse, you can't really appreciate it, but it will be too blurred to follow. Okay? So that's my question. Well, you could say, well, it is related to mathematics, right? That's how I give math talks. But it isn't really related to mathematics, because I could have been an art historian talking about aspects of the eyes of the Mona Lisa, and I would want to move from one eye to the other eye while generating the least blur. Or I could be an environmentalist. Something got messed up in the image. I could be an environmentalist showing a world map with colors representing CO2 emissions, and then I could say that heavy CO2 emissions in one place may make penguins on some other part of the universe unhappy. Okay? It's not really, it doesn't really have anything to do with the fact that I'm a mathematician. Mathematician. What is going on? Program is supposed to work when I demo it. Sorry, I have to restart it. Where was I? You see, that's why technology should be tried. Anyway, so let's go back to the problem. So here is an equivalent formulation of the problem. Okay? Instead of asking how do I move fastest from here to here, sorry, how do I move in the least amount of time from here to here given a fixed amount of blur, sorry, how do I move fastest from here to here given that I, no, it's just the same. What am I doing? Sorry. Here is a formula and another way of stating the problem. I want to move my video camera from here, right above the left eye of the Mona Lisa, to here, right above the right eye of the Mona Lisa, and I fix for myself a certain blur limit. How much blur I'm ready to tolerate. Now, if you think about it, if I have a fixed tolerance for blur, it means that at altitude 20 centimeters, I can move at a certain speed limit, 20. Okay? And if I'm, right, that will generate a certain amount of blur. And if I double the distance, I can move twice as fast. Right? Because the image appears to be moving half as quickly. So basically, I have a plane. I have two points on that plane, the initial point for the camera and the final point for the camera, and I need to get from one to the other in the fastest possible way, given that I have speed limits, and the speed limits are proportional to the distance from the monoplane, from the bottom. Okay? So the speed limit is 20 along this orange, along these orange dots, and 40 along these orange dots, and 60 along the next layer, and so on. So how do I do that? What's the fastest way to go from here to here, given these constraints? Okay, so before solving this, let me tell you that there are other problems with the same nature. So for example, there is the classic brachistochrone problem. Have you heard about it before? So it's a very famous problem. Supposedly, I think Bernoulli asked this problem, and then Newton sent him an anonymous solution. And when Bernoulli read the solution, he said, "I recognize the lion by his paw." Okay, so he could tell it was Newton who did it. Okay, but anyway, here's the problem. Well, you have a certain, I don't know what, load, box, and you want it to slide from this point to that point in the fastest along, in the fastest possible way. Assume that there is no friction. So you just have to generate or produce or design a slide that will get you this box from here to here in the fastest possible way. So a silly way to do it would be to make the slide the other way around. So sort of it starts flat, goes to here, and then falls down here. It's silly because you start slowly, waste a lot of time, and you will eventually you'll get there, but you will have wasted a lot of time. A better way to do it would be to drop down quickly in the beginning so as to generate speed, so as to get speed, and then start moving horizontally. But the question is, what is the precise optimal path along which to do it? So it turns out that it's a problem of the exact same nature, because there is a conservation of energy law in physics, which says that the potential energy has to be equal to the what is it called, kinetic energy. And this means that the velocity at any given depth is fixed. No matter what trajectory you choose, when you reach this depth, your velocity will be roughly or proportional to the square root of the depth. That's conservation of energy. Okay, so you may as well consider it as if you have speed limits, you know, square root of 50 here, square root of 40 over here, square root of 30 over here, and so on. And the question is, given these speed limits, how to best go from this point to that point. So you can see it's a problem of the same pattern. It's not the same problem because these are different speed limits, but it's a problem from the same place, okay? So, well, I will not tell you what the solution is. I mean, you have a homework assignment, yet another homework assignment. Figure it out. If Newton could, you can too. Okay? There are other problems of the same nature. So, you know, suppose we didn't know that Earth was a sphere. Okay? Suppose we had thought that Earth was a plane. Okay? Eventually we would notice, we would make a map of Earth, and eventually we would notice that when we are in the far north, we tend to move faster on that map. Okay? So then we could ask ourselves how to get from Toronto to Tokyo along the fastest possible route. And obviously, again, the fastest route is to go up north where you can go faster and then go back down. And in fact, that's what airplanes do. Okay? Now, why do they do it? Well, they do it for a different reason. They do it because they realize that the Earth is a, well, the map was just a projection of Earth, and Earth is really a sphere. And to go from Toronto over here to Tokyo over there, the best way is to go along, what is it called, a long circle?
Great
circle, okay, which tends to go near the North Pole in this case, okay? So going back to my problem, okay, the move the camera problem that I started with, well, maybe there is a solution along the same lines. So maybe I can find a funny shape so that, well, in fact, our problem is of a similar nature, but the numbers are different. Okay, so that sort of when you, where you're down below, you appear to move slowly. When you're up above, you think you can move fast because the world is sort of smaller. So every small motion, motion appears big. Okay, so maybe we can find such a space, and then the fastest way for the camera to go in real space would be, given the speed limits that were given, would be the shortest route along this funny shape. The answer is that it can more or less be done, but not quite. So first of all, you can do it, but only for part of the space. So you see this picture is chopped and there is a reason. It only describes a part of the possible positionings of the camera, the possible position, state space of the camera. Also, how on earth did we find this? So the sphere was somehow natural, but how on earth would you come up with these formulas? And coming up with these formulas is probably harder than solving the original problem. And finally, suppose I told you that this shape, given by these formulas, corresponds to the moving camera problem of before. So what? I mean, how would you find the best path from here to here? It's not a great circle. It's a great something, but I don't know great what. Okay? So this is useless. So instead, let's do something else and tell you about the happy segue principle. You all know what a segue is, right? Right? So a segue is like a bicycle, but it, and so in the sense that it has two wheels, but the two wheels are parallel to each other instead of one behind the other. Okay? So, you know, if a bicycle moves, it makes a path like that. It looks like two parallel, nearly parallel paths. Okay? The happy segue principle says that a segue is happy if and only if both its wheels are. This is under certain assumptions that I will, you know, not make perfectly, I will not state perfectly, but under reasonable assumptions. So what do I mean by that? So when is a segue happy? A segue is happy if it is going from point A to point B along the fastest possible path, given the speed limits that are, you know, around, that are given to you. Okay? So a Segway is happy if it's going along the fastest route from point A to point B, given the speed limits. When are the wheels happy? So each individual wheel is happy if it's going at speed limit, precisely at speed limit. Now notice that a Segway has a certain width, so the wheels do not necessarily go at the same speed. So in fact, if you go from here to here along the shortest possible route, both wheels are going at the same speed. You can fix this speed to be the speed limit. You're going along a straight line and you're happy. Okay? If you go along this path, then if you obey the law and the external wheel goes at speed limit, the internal wheel must be going below speed limit. Okay? So along this path, not both wheels are happy at the same time. Okay, it is not the case that both wheels are happy at the same time, or are both happy. Okay? Now, why is this path not optimal? Because you see, if you have one wheel that's going below speed limit, you can move the entire path a little bit, epsilon, in the direction of that wheel. Assuming, making reasonable assumptions of continuity, and these are the assumptions that I didn't make, now both wheels would be going below speed limit. Right? If I move the path a little bit this way, now both wheels are going below speed limit, so I could speed up a bit, so I could get from here to here faster, so that wasn't the optimal path. And that's basically the proof, again, modulo technical assumptions, that's the proof of the happy Segway principle. So let's, is it okay, are you with me?
Yes.
So let's apply the happy Segway principle in the case of, you know, camera carrying Segways above the monoplane. Here's the monoplane. I want to move from one point in the monoplane to another point in the monoplane, so that both wheels of my Segway are always happy. Okay? So first of all, here is an unhappy Segway. It's moving along a straight line. This is not an optimal way to go, because here, the you know, if you're moving along a straight line, both wheels are spinning at the same speed. However, the speed limit, our design of speed limits is such that the upper wheel could have actually gone a bit faster. Okay? So the upper wheel is right now below speed limit. So not both wheels are happy. And indeed, I could have pushed this whole path to be a bit convex like this. Okay? And now both wheels would be going below speed limit, and I could speed up, and I could get from point A to point B a bit faster. So that's not how you want to go. But that's what I said in the beginning. You don't want to go along a straight line. Okay, that was an unhappy segue. Here are two happy segues. So one happy segue shoots straight up. Okay? So the wheels are always parallel. The wheels are always at the same distance from the monoplane, therefore the speed limits for both of them are the same. So in fact, our Segway will be moving slowly at the bottom, and then it will be speeding up as we go, because the higher up we can move faster, but it's both wheels are equally happy, so this would be the best way to get from a point to a point right above it. Okay? From the perspective of my original problem, this is not saying much. I just told you that if I want to zoom out from here to a point right above it, I should just zoom out along a straight line. But that's kind of not surprising. But here is the more interesting part of the problem, here is the more interesting happy segue. So I claim that a segue that walks along a semicircular arc, which is perpendicular to the monoplane at both ends, or in other words, it's half of a circle whose center is on the monoplane. So I claim that such a segue is happy. So, again, to be precise about the happy segue principle, I really should be talking about infinitesimal segues. So I really should be talking about segues whose separation, for which the separation between the wheels is tiny, 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 tiny. Okay? But in this particular case, it actually doesn't matter what the separation of the wheels is. This segue going along a semicircular arc will be happy no matter how big it is. So let's try to see why this is so. So suppose the outer radius, so the radius along which the outer wheel is going, is r. Suppose the inner radius is 0.9r, 90%, okay? But it could be 0.999 or it could be, anything, okay? Then, by very simple, what is it called? Congruence of triangles?
Similarity
of triangles. You can figure out that if the outer wheel is at altitude y, the inner wheel will be at altitude or at height 0.9y. So the outer wheel is allowed to move at speed y, and the inner wheel is allowed to move at speed 90% of the outer wheel. But the distance that the inner wheel has to cover is 90% of the distance that the outer wheel has to cover. So if one is happy, so is the other. Are you with me? So according to the happy segue principle, going from any point along, I displayed it as if I'm going from here to here, but the same argument would have been right going from any point along this semicircle to any other point along this semicircle. So we've almost solved the problem, right? If I want to move from here to here, I draw a semi, well, I find a point on the monoplane which is equidistant from the two points that I want to move between. And then I draw the semicircle whose center is that point, and I move along that semicircle. That's the answer. You know, maybe it's modest, but it's the hardest math problem I've ever really used. Anyway, just an aside, so this is actually way more important than it seems. This is the first bit of so-called hyperbolic geometry originally discovered by Lobachevsky, who solved a very, very old open problem. So there are the axioms of geometry, and the last axiom is the axiom of parallels, which says that if you have a line and a point outside of this line, so you have a straight line and a point outside of that line, then there is precisely one line going through the other point, which is parallel to the first. So for many years, people were trying to prove that this axiom follows from the other axioms of geometry and failed. Then came Lobachevsky and started playing with segues, or maybe he had other motivations, I'm not sure. But he came up with the so-called hyperbolic plane. In the hyperbolic plane, the straight lines are happy segues. Okay? So the hyperbolic plane is actually half a plane. It's only the part of the plane that is above the purple line. And we declare that a straight line is, well, either a straight line shooting up, or a semicircular happy segue. You can check that all other axioms are satisfied. So, if two lines meet, they meet at most one point. between any two lines there is exactly one path that you can, a straight line connecting them, straight line in the Lobachevsky sense. Okay? Except, so all axioms are satisfied except the axiom of parallels. So indeed, this happy segue, well, here's one happy segue, the external one. Here's a point not on it. And here are two lines, both parallel to the external line, in the sense that neither one of them meets it, but they're not the same. Okay? So that's sort of, if you wish, I think this is also the easiest way I know of discovering hyperbolic geometry. So I told you we solved the problem, but we haven't quite, because it's not enough to know that I need to move from here to here along a semicircle. I also need to know what is the parametrization of this semicircle. I need to know at time t, where am I? Right? Because I want to write a computer program that would move my handout around, and I need to give it some concrete number. I need to tell it where to be. It's not enough that I tell it to be along a certain line or along a certain semicircle. So the parametrization thing is unfortunately a bit more involved. Well, it turns out that we need to solve a certain differential equation. Namely, well, I know that I need to know along a semicircle, so I know that at, so I know that I need to be at position cosine theta sine theta for some theta. I also know that my velocity is the derivative of theta. Right? So theta prime, the velocity, must be proportional to the height. And if you drop the constant of proportionality, you need to solve the differential equation. Theta prime of t is equal to sine of theta of t. You know, you either learn a few techniques from differential equations, or you type it into a sufficiently good computer algebra system. Whatever way you, whichever way you do, you find that theta is equal to twice the arctangens of e to the t. And now we've parameterized our path. Now we know at which theta to be at any given t. Okay? If you don't believe me, you can just take this theta, feed it into this, meaning differentiate this, and find that it satisfies this differential equation. Well, it's actually not over because, sorry, there is a little more to do. Because you see, if I have point A, I want to get from point A to point B, I actually have to find the center of the circle. So I have to construct the perpendicular bisector, find this point. So I have to do a little bit of further plane geometry. I'm just telling you how hard is the hardest math that I've ever done. So this is how hard it is. It's much harder than addition and multiplication. And here's the code. If you look closely at this code, you'll find, well, you'll find various things that have to do with the analytic geometry, finding the perpendicular bisector and all that nonsense. Then you'll find that T1, the time at point A, is given by the inverse function of this function given here. So the logarithm of the tangents of the theta divided by 2, likewise for t2. Then I find t3, the intermediate, the point, the time in some intermediate point. Then I compute this function. So here it is, twice the arctangents of the exponential of t3. And of course, this bit of code is surrounded by a huge amount of sort of bookkeeping code that actually moves the image around. And if you look at this code a little more, you'll find that it uses quite a lot of operations. So there is plus, there is minus, there is times, there is divide, there is square root, there is cosine, there is sine, there is tangent. Well, there is all of these things, which is a lot more than I have ever expected myself to use in real life. And let me finish by a bit of an ideological statement. I despise the real numbers. And let me explain. So you know what? I've despised them for many years. I never liked the real numbers. Okay? And the reasoning is, so there is a philosophical reason. Sort of the real numbers, they're called real, but they're completely imaginary. Okay? You know, a real number is an infinite sequence of things. It's a limit of, it's a process, it's a limiting process. Or it's dependent on having infinitely many decimal digits at the same time. It's nonsense. I've never held infinity in my hands in my life before. I don't believe in infinity. I think real numbers are just nonsense. Or you know what, maybe they're not nonsense, but they're definitely creatures of our imagination. Okay? Anyway, how is it related to my problem, to my program? It's related in the following way. You see, this is the interesting bit of code. But there is also a less interesting bit of code. The less interesting bit of code is where you have to move from a point B to a point A, which is directly vertically above it. Okay? Because if you need to move directly vertically up, you need to use a slightly different, well, I mean, you need to use a different formula. You need to use the formula for a straight line, which is actually easier. Okay? So your program, so the program actually, the part of the program that is not shown here has a little if statement. And the if says, if x coordinate of A equals x coordinate of B, do the easy thing. Except, you know, sort of this if sounds great when you think real numbers, but computers don't do real numbers because computers exist and real numbers don't. So computers do approximate real numbers and there are round of errors. And when you tell the computer if x of A is equal to x of B, it's going to say, no, they're not equal, they differ by 10 to the minus 12. And then you'll be going to this part of the program where somewhere you will be dividing by the difference, you'll be dividing essentially by zero, okay? That's, which is in itself against the law, okay? But, well, you will be dividing by 10 to the minus 12, which amounts to saying that you will be multiplying somewhere by a huge number. You'll get things which are numerically unstable, you'll get a whole mess. And indeed, for a while, I noticed that every time I try to zoom straight out, my program, instead of, even though that, you know, I look at the code, I see this parameterization of a straight line, I know what it is, I know it's right. Okay, and yet the program just behaves completely insane. And it took me hours to find the bug. Okay, so the bug is, computers are real, real numbers are imaginary. That's the end of my lecture. Code now says if the distance is less than 10 to the minus 9, it's declared to be equal. I mean, it's declared to be the same.
In particular, this talk actually uses this algorithm.
What? Oh, of course, this talk uses this algorithm. I mean, that's sort of obvious. My own.